A couple of other points about 529. Julian already mentioned one of the more unique features of this type of investment vehicle, which is that anyone can make a contribution to it. But another unique feature is that you don't actually have to be the parent of the child in question to open one.
Yes.
You can open a 529 for just about anybody as long as you have their social security number. That means that grandparents can set up an account on behalf of their grandchildren, or if you are a self-proclaimed rich auntie, you can set up an account on behalf of your nieces and nephews. So just keep that in mind that you may be child-free by choice, or maybe your kid is already taken care of. You can still kind of create these accounts for children in your life that you know will ultimately need it.
Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
And I'm Kirsten, and today's episode is about investing accounts for the youth,
yeah.
The minors, the children.
We love the kids.
The pickney.
Yeah. Oh, that last one was a little outside of your range, so let's not do that.
I know. I'm working on my Caribbean accent.
Yeah. We just booked a vacation to Jamaica, so maybe that's why it's top of mind. anyway, this is a timely episode because I just wrote an article about this, or not just, it was a couple of weeks ago by the time this article or this podcast is published, but it is a article on Next Advisor, which is a subsidiary of Time Magazine. And I spoke a little bit about what we're doing for our son, Bo. So the article is kind of, you know, it's an article that's been, let's just say it's been done before, right? There have been a couple of articles over the last couple of years that really went viral because they were talking about what some of these younger entrepreneurs and workers are doing to set their kids up, the types of strategies and investing accounts that they're doing to ensure that when their kid graduates from high school, they'll be a millionaire or, you know, something like that, which I think is fantastic. What I wanted to do was actually just be a little bit more reasonable, right? Like, while that is possible, and I'm certainly not knocking that, a lot of people aren't like trying to ensure that they're child becomes richy rich by the time they're walking across the graduation for high school. So we wanted to just focus on what can be done and help people realize that how even just a little bit can actually be something really meaningful and help give your children a leg up.
Yeah. I think two of the things that kind of get lost in the conversation about investing for children is that one, that it has to be this astronomical amount of money in order to be meaningful, instead of a reasonable amount like 50 or 100 bucks a month. And then two, that the only way to gift money to minors in your life is through estate planning or like a death benefit once you've passed away. Right. And neither could be more false. First of all, there's a reason they call compound interest the eighth wonder of the world. Small amounts invested consistently over 10 years is enough to leave a sizable balance. But if you take it further and do it for maybe 18 years, that child is well on their way to a happy life. There's actually this book called Die with Zero that I haven't read yet, but it's next on my list. And it came out a couple of years ago, which, you know, with a title like that, it made the timing very awkward given the pandemic. But the book is really about the trade-offs that we all make between how we save and how we live. Mm-hmm. And one of the major premises of the book is that we should all aim to leave this earth with our bank accounts at $0 and spend the rest of our money on living a great life, which sort of challenges this cultural pressure, this idea that you should leave something behind for your loved ones or for your children. And his counterpoint is actually that statistically speaking, strategic gifts to your children, ideally while you're alive at different points in their life, are more meaningful and enduring than a larger payout at the end, right? Yeah. So in other words, a person who receives $30,000 when they turn 25 to help them buy a car or put a down payment on a house has a greater impact than the person who gets $90,000 at, you know, the end of your life or whatever. Yeah. So like, I'm so intrigued by this, book. What do you think?
Obviously the title itself is intriguing. I'm more interested in kind of the way that you described it and the value of that approach, because I kind of agree with that part. But yeah, I just think that we should be doing our part to protect and pass on wealth to the best of our abilities. Like, yeah. And it's not just so that our future generations can live this luxurious lifestyle, but so that they have like a leg up. Like yeah. starting at $1,000 is better than starting at zero.
Exactly.
Like starting at 10,000 is better than one. Starting at 100, yeah. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so it doesn't always have to be multiples of millions of dollars. And again, going back to some of the other articles that we've seen, I'm not saying those are bad things. I'm just saying like, they can be unrelatable when people are saying, all right, well, I can't do that. Or I'm not even trying to aim for that. I just want to make sure that they get to college, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was much more interested in ensuring that people could realize that actually there are several opportunities throughout the year. This is just an alternative way to think about what I could do with this particular money.
Yeah.
I did not come from money, but I'd be lying if even in my situation, I did not admit that I was helped by my father, who gave me $5,000 in 2007 when I bought my first home. Now, granted, I think buying my first home was the worst financial decision of my life, but that's not his fault. That's the fault of like Wall Street greed and people double dipping and gambling with mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
But anyway, my point is like just being in that position was enough to allow me to buy my first home, which I think is simple things like that, to your point, like just being able to afford to get through that first year of college and you can figure out your way afterwards versus knowing that it's not a possibility at all because you don't have the money, I think can be problematic. So I don't know that I completely, you know, agree with die with zero. But you know, but I understand you got to do what you got to get people to open up the book. And
I like the idea of dying with zero, although it's kind of an impossible goal because you can't really predict when you're going to die. And if you're wrong, it just means you got a whole, you just got a whole nother problem. Like I ran out of money. So if you're not taking it literally, I like it as a goal, like metaphorically speaking. And I also fundamentally agree that there are times when it's better to give sooner rather than later.
Yes.
So today I thought we could discuss a couple of options for investing for children and kind of the pros and cons associated with each of them. And since you already mentioned one of them in talking about the article that you wrote, why don't we start with custodial brokerage accounts?
Let's do it. So the first type of account is exactly what you just said. It's a custodial brokerage account. These accounts are different from regular savings accounts. We recommend having both, by the way. With a kids' bank account, both the parent and the child can use it. And it's great for teaching children the fundamentals of financial literacy and helping them to build basic money habits and accomplish short-term goals. Custodial accounts are a little different in a sense that they're investment accounts that adults manage, typically parents or guardians, on behalf of the child until they reach like between the ages of 18 or 21. That depends on the state that you're in, which you'll see is a running thing when it comes to a lot of these types of accounts. But the purpose of those accounts are more so for long-term needs, right? So you might have a savings account for a child who wants to save up so that they can go to space camp. A custodial account is going to be something that...
when they want to go to space.
When they want to go to space. You want to go to space? Space.
Space.
Oh, I was going to take you to Florida. Are you trying to go to the moon? Okay. But we're going to have to save up and actually do a little bit more for that. So there are two common types custodial accounts for kids. And this is where financial jargon gets a little
ugly. I do like these words, though.
UGMA is the first one. UGMA. Uniform Gift to Minors Act, also known as UGMA. And then there's UTMA, which is UTMA, Uniform Transfer to Minors Act. Very typical when it comes to accounts, they're like named after the piece of legislation that actually made them possible. So the difference is a UGMA lets you buy stocks, bonds, and mutual funds on behalf of a minor. UTMAs allow you to invest and transfer any property like real estate or things like art or collectibles without needing a trust, right? So those are kind of the differences between the two. Unlike a 529, which again, another type of investing account for college education for children with all kinds of state implications, the money from a custodial account can actually be used for anything, whereas a 529 is really just for qualified educational expenses. It could be used to help start a business, you know, support social causes. Our son could decide that he just wants to be a philanthropist when he's under 21. It's perfectly fine. Or he wants to purchase his dream car because he really loves those. Whatever he chooses is completely up to him. We see the custodial account as the custodians as a great way to store gifts or surprise money, which is what we opened the first one for. Now, if your child is able to work part-time or has any kind of earned income, whether that's through your own business, like our son has, or through an employer, like, I don't know, your local fast food restaurant, you're able to open another type of account, which is called a custodial Roth IRA. And I know I'm throwing a lot of these types of accounts at you, but the big difference here as we're kind of turning the page is like one is more so for like, hey, if you got money, it comes from your dad or your uncle or something like that. This is more like you went to work, you got a paycheck, you've got to pay taxes on that. Here's kind of how we want to treat that income because the IRS certainly sees those two differently. So with a custodial Roth IRA, you're actually allowed to have that money grow tax-free and they can withdraw it with no penalty at 59 and a half, like most Roth IRAs. The IRS will waive the 10% tax penalty for early withdrawals for a few exceptions, one of which is higher education. So you could actually use it very similar as a 529. But you can also use these expenses for things like tuition, fees, books. And again, it kind of makes it similar and kind of comparable to a 529, but it's a little different when it comes to like the way that it's treated in terms of taxes and the amount that you can actually contribute. Now, bear in mind, if your child is earning income, the IRS will come knocking.
Yep.
So just like everyone else. But the good news is, and what a lot of financially savvy adults do is they open these types of accounts really as a shelter where it's like saying, all right, well, just like everyone else, there is a minimum amount of money that you are able to deduct and basically earn tax-free without having to pay federal income taxes on it. And so you can basically store that money in these types of accounts, allow it to grow tax-free. And thus, this is how the rich stay rich and get richer. Hashtag yeah. Secrets of the wealthy. Hashtag get you a CPA to help
hashtag
you.
Hashtag space.
I mean, this is how it works. But yeah. I think the point is, it's really not that complicated, right?
Yeah.
You got a job or you don't have a job. You got some money coming in. You open an account very similar as you would a checking or a savings. You're just investing this money instead of just storing it in cash and allowing it to grow over time. And again, things get a little complicated, but that's where you can ask for a CPA to give you some guidance.
Yeah. So I do want to zoom out of the definitions a little bit and give a little perspective with some numbers. So let's say when your child is born, you invest $2,000 into a custodial investment IRA account without ever investing another dollar. You just have $2,000, you put it in there and you let it sit. That child would have almost $1 million by the time they turn 65, assuming an average 10% rate of return. That's the benefit of letting money sit for 65 years.
Well, compound.
Compound. Just to
be,
correct.
Just to be clear.
Correct. Compound. That's a better word. Because if you put it in a savings account in 65 years, you might
correct.
Have
your savings rate might
$10.
Be 1%. It might be 0.5.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're taking advantage of the new promo and it's 1.5. It's
yeah.
certainly not going to be $1 million by the time they turn 65.
Yes.
You might have 2,500.
Maybe. Yeah. Now, if you start a business, as Julian mentioned, you can hire your children under the age of 18 and pay them up to the standard deduction of almost $13,000 in 2022. It's $12,950. That money is fully tax deductible to you if your business is a sole proprietorship or an LLC taxed as a sole proprietorship like ours is. Also, your child won't owe any income or employment taxes because it's right below that threshold of when you have to start paying taxes. Now, the wage that you pay your children has to be reasonable for the job, right? So if you have a, say, 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, very hard to justify paying them $13,000 unless they're actually spending a lot of time on the business. If they are, then yeah, great. But let's just say something more reasonable, like $500 a month, which adds up to $6,000 a year. By the time your 8-year-old is 19 years old, there'll be over $100,000 in this account. Again, assuming an average annual rate of return of 10%, that 18-year-old can use to pay for college, assuming that's in their plans, or can just continue to hold until they are 65, 59 and a half, whatever.
They
can do whatever they want.
Yep. Opening a custodial account is pretty simple as well. Like, again, a lot of this stuff is really simple, and I'm hoping that we can help to debunk or help a lot of you who are out there listening to kind of overcome the intimidation of it all. A lot of this stuff can be done online. Like, I think I opened our son's custodial account in like 10 minutes or something like that. All you need is basic information. You need their name, birth date, and social security number. Secondly, if it's a custodial account, you're going to need to provide the same information for you, the custodian or custodians, assuming you have multiple people who will have access and control over the money. And lastly, you just need to link that new account to a funding account, like a personal checking or savings account, which might be something that you already have. But if not, the process of opening those accounts are likely very similar. And you treat it the same way you would any other taxable brokerage account that you have, or any other investment account for that matter. You're simply linking the two so that you can transfer money in, so that you can then use it to buy stocks, mutual funds, or whatever it is that you'd like to invest in. We open ours through Fidelity, but you can also use things like Acorns, which they have an option called Acorns Early, specifically for these purposes. Once you open it, you just need to decide on what your investments are. So our preferred approach to investing is in total stock market index funds for the vast majority of our holdings, because they're diversified, they are affordable relative to more expensive, actively managed mutual funds. But in this case, with respect to our son, considering this was gift money, we're actually willing to be a little riskier, to assume a little greater risk for the likelihood of a little greater return. And so rather than going with a total stock market index fund, we actually opted for a sector fund. And the particular sector that we were interested in was the tech sector, because we've seen a ton of growth in tech sector funds over the last 10 years, honestly 20 years, probably more than that, really. And there's really no reasonable reason for us to believe that this is not going to continue into the foreseeable future. So when we talk about a tech sector fund, we're talking about a mutual fund that is mostly or wholly comprised of tech stocks like Apple, Microsoft, Salesforce, Cisco, you name it, all of these tech companies. And so a tech sector fund is likely going to be mostly, if not 100%, comprised of those types of funds. Little different from a total stock market index fund, where 30% of them, or maybe 20%, might be comprised of tech funds. So they are a little bit more aggressive. They are a little bumpier as they're growing, but the growth potential over a shorter time frame, in this case, like 18, 20 years, is significantly higher than you would get with a total stock market approach. So that's why we're thinking about it with respect to our son's custodial account.
Great. All right. So we've talked about three different custodial accounts. There's UGMAs, UTMAs, and custodial Roth IRAs. We also touched on the importance of kids having savings accounts or checking accounts so they can learn basic money habits. I don't want to diminish the importance of that. So we'll probably swing back around at the end of the episode to just highlight some of your more basic options.
Yep.
But when we come back from break, I want to talk a little bit about another type of investment that we've mentioned a couple of times. It is the 529 accounts. So we actually did an episode on 529s about a year ago. It's episode 15 for those keeping score, where we debunk a lot of the hesitation around opening these types of accounts. But I do want to start with the definition, as we typically do. So a 529 is like many financial products and is named after the section in the IRS code, section 529. Ah, like, I just feel like so much of financial literacy could be resolved if we would just name things what they are. An educational savings account, like, why, like a ESA? No. I'm like, what?
By the time I'm done telling you UTMAs, UGMAs, 529s, yeah, IRAs, 401ks, good and 403Bs, Lord. I need you to be good and confused.
Yeah. So if you ever get bored, read section 529 of the IRS tax code. So 529 is a tax advantage investment account where parents and other loved ones can invest money for qualified educational expenses. And it's not just college. Sometimes we'll use the word college fund because it started that way, but it has since expanded into this really flexible option that you can use across education from K through 12. So contributions in a 529 can grow tax-free from federal taxes, and the money can be withdrawn tax-free only when it's used for qualified expenses. Now, most states will also offer a state tax deduction as an additional incentive, but the amount varies state to state. So I can't tell you what it is based off where you live. Look it up. But this is a key differentiator between UGMA and UTMA accounts, because they do not offer tax-free withdrawal withdrawals like 529 plans, but they also don't have to be exclusively used towards education like 529 plans. So those are the two trade-offs that you're making between those accounts.
Yeah, I was joking, but I want to make sure I'm talking about this in a way that I think people understand with respect to other adults, right? So we talk about this in our book. There was a very early moment in our life where we learned about 529 plans. And again, as relatively, we were new parents at the time. We were super excited about being financially savvy and preparing for our son's future. And I remember sharing that we'd opened a 529 for our son and we had a birthday party. And we were telling people like, you know, we don't need more stuff. Like he's got enough trucks. He's got enough, all this stuff. Like, honestly, you could just make a deposit into his 529 and we'd be great. Like if anything, like you don't have to do anything. And we were met with like such vitriol.
Yeah, they were mad.
People were like,
that's tacky.
The nerve of you to ask
get the baby
us
some
to
toys.
Pay for your son's
what's
going
he gonna
to college.
Play with?
The nerve of you to bring more plastic junk into my house or to give him more t-shirts and toys that he absolutely does not need and we will just end up sending to the Goodwill in our local neighborhood in a couple of months. But okay, you can have it. The point is, it's actually really easy for people to do it. So if you've ever used like PayPal or something like that, like if you have a 529 account, at least ours in Georgia, you can just get a link and you can send that link to people. Here's his link. And if you want to make a deposit at any time for any reason, those people can actually do it the same as they would if they were making a donation to a nonprofit organization. Yep. And they can then claim a deduction on their own taxes for having done so. So it's something for you guys to really think about. Hopefully your friends and family don't react the way ours did, but it's something that I wanted to make sure is an option because I think it's actually one of the most important and valuable features with respect to 529s because other accounts don't work that way. So with respect to how we manage ours, you can have the option, just like any others, to auto-fund it. You can basically drip feed and send money into an account, or you can do it occasionally. In our case, we use gift money. So my father specifically, he's old school. He still writes checks Christmas and on our son's birthday. We take those checks and for the most part, it goes right into his 529. If my dad wanted the tax refund, he could do exactly what I've recommended, but he doesn't do that. So
he likes to write a check.
He likes to write the check.
And send a card.
And send a little, no, it's not a card. He folded up in a piece of paper.
That's right.
And then send it.
Your aunt sends a card.
My aunt sends cards. She's like the last person that I know that actually still sends cards. But yeah, that's an option. Another way is to set it up as a percentage of your annual income. So if we're having a gangbusters kind of year, since our income is variable, we might decide that, hey, like after we've hit a certain milestone or after we've hit a certain benchmark, let's go ahead and dump X amount of dollars into the 529 clan. But we tend to use other benchmarks, which are typically set by the amount that we can offset of that contribution in taxes. So what do I mean by that? For if married coupled in the state of Georgia filing jointly, we can actually contribute up to $8,000 a year to our son's 529 plan. So if we decided to put in $8,000, we can deduct that from our taxable income. Our CPA will say, yes, congratulations to you. For people not filing jointly, basically everyone else in the state of Georgia, you can only contribute up to $4,000 that is tax deductible. So not to say that you can't contribute more, but only $4,000 would be tax deductible. In our case, only $8,000 would be tax deductible, which I think is a pretty sizable amount for what we're trying to accomplish, especially when you consider compounding over like almost two decades. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money. We are not contributing nearly that much, but it is an option. And just wanted to make sure that we were clear that there are a number of different ways that you could set up or think about your investing strategy. And it doesn't necessarily have to differentiate that much from the way that you're investing in any of the other accounts that you have.
Yeah, a couple of other points about 529. Julian already mentioned one of the more unique features of this type of investment vehicle, which is that anyone can make a contribution to it. But another unique feature is that you don't actually have to be the parent of the child in question to open one.
Yes.
You can open a 529 for just about anybody as long as you have their social security number. That means that grandparents can set up an account on behalf of their grandchildren, or if you are a self-proclaimed rich auntie, you can set up an account on behalf of your nieces and nephews. So just keep that in mind that you may be child-free by choice, or maybe your kid is already taken care of. You can still kind of create these accounts for children in your life that you know will ultimately need it.
Yep.
The other thing to consider with 529 plans is that unlike a retirement plan, you don't actually have 30 to 40 years time horizon unless you're, you know, investing in a non-traditional student, which exists. There are non-traditional students who go to school at older ages. But when most people think about higher education and the benefits of these accounts, they're thinking about the years that are shortly after high school. So assuming you start saving when your child is, say, 5 and plan to use the funds when the child turns 18, you might have a 10 to 15 year window for the balance to grow. So that you want to factor that into your investment strategy. You don't have nearly as long of a runway as you would with like a traditional retirement account.
Yep. Yep. Okay. So you may be wondering, how should I approach investing? Like, should it be the same as my other accounts? And I kind of alluded to this, so let's flush that out a little bit. This is one of the reasons why mutual fund options like target date funds exist. Target date funds are basically actively managed mutual funds that are designed with target dates in mind. So in this case, let's say we're talking about a child that is going to be presumably the class of 2037. You might decide that in your investment account or in that 529 that you're actually going to invest the funds that you've transferred into it into the target date fund, which is probably going to be called something like target date fund 2037. Mm-hmm. And you can just invest in that. And that is managed in a way to optimize or maximize growth in line with that particular time frame. And you would want to do that versus, let's say, a regular sort of total stock market index fund, because those funds are not designed to optimize exactly in any particular day. They're going to do whatever the market thinks is ideal.
Yeah.
So what you don't want to be is in a situation where you actually need that money, very similar to retirement, but you have overinvested, and as a result, we've hit a downturn and you've actually lost a significant degree of value in that portfolio because of any number of reasons. Those funds are managed and adjusted so that those kinds of things are less likely to happen. But just being honest, you're going to pay a little bit for people to be able to ensure that that is happening accordingly. So something to keep in mind. The other thing about target date funds that I think is great is that if you're planning to use the funds to pay for college, but it gets more complicated for people who want to use it for like K through 12 expenses, because you have even less time for that money to compound. And in that case, our advice would be to front load your annual contribution so you have the full year to compound instead of drip by drip monthly installments. In other words, instead of sending money every single month like you would to your retirement account, you can make one lump sum investment at the beginning of the year. I'll also say, if you're like us and you're not actually trying to cover the full cost of college, just like enough, then you can invest any way that you like. Like for us, we're choosing to be aggressive in our Sons Custodial account because it's gift money. And in our 529, we're not nearly as aggressive because we've worked for that money, or he worked for that money. So we opt for a more simple approach, and we are fine with monitoring it like other accounts, and we'll reallocate at certain points to make sure that we don't put ourselves in a situation where we're approaching a withdrawal date, but we're suffering because the market is negatively impacted by our investment decisions.
All right. So one last watch out before we get into the last type of account that we want to talk about is the implications to future financial aid. Depending on what type of account you open and that account's ownership, you could have an impact on future financial aid through FAFSA. So for example, money in a custodial IRA would not be reported as an asset of FAFSA. And 529s have a minimal impact because they still have the parents' names on the account. But assets in an UGMA or an UTMA or a brokerage can affect eligibility for financial aid because they're considered student assets and they're weighed more heavily than parental assets. So if you are a child that has $10,000, $12,000, $30,000 in their name, that's considered an asset when it comes to financial aid and they may qualify for less. So it's just something to keep in mind as you're deciding which accounts you want to invest in. Now, the last type of account we want to talk about, particularly for those of you with older kids, is just a basic, simple, tried and true brokerage account. So some brokers have created accounts that are specifically designed for teenagers. For example, Fidelity has this youth account that's available for teens that are aged 13 to 17. And most of these come with a debit card, so they have access to a portion of their funds that they don't have invested. Now, unlike the other options that require a parent or a relative to be the custodian of these accounts, your teen actually owns the account. But we highly recommend that you use the apps that each of these brokerages offer to kind of monitor their activity. These accounts also don't have the tax advantage of the other options, but if you've been looking for a hands-on way to teach kids in your life concepts like buy and hold, stocks, bonds, yep, ETFs, this may be an option for you to give them a little bit of freedom to deposit their paychecks or whatever kind of gift money that they get and have their own account in their own name. Just to keep in mind what I just said about financial aid, that these types of things do count as student assets and not parental or shared assets.
I'd be curious to see what happens, but I do not see these types of accounts taking off.
You don't think so?
No. No, there's so much. I mean, I know more parents who complain about their kids accidentally ordering things using the Echo or, you know, something like that. Like, I can't see a world where parents are comfortable just allowing their teenagers financial decisions.
You don't need parental advice.
And they may not need them to do it,
but
that doesn't mean that they can't restrict them. Like, I think that that's going to be, not to mention, we're talking about a kid, and very few of them are going to choose to make a decision for the long term versus being able to enjoy something today.
I think that's pre-TikTok. I don't know. Like, there are a lot of 13-year-olds who understand the role of investing more than any other generation before.
I do agree with that.
And so if you've seen enough on TikTok and maybe your parents aren't financially literate or aren't into investing, this is an option for them to get started. So you may know a kid in your life. It's probably not you if you're listening to this podcast, but you may have a niece, nephew, neighbor that you can introduce this account to and say, actually, as a 15-year-old who has a job, you can open up your own brokerage account through, you know, any of these youth accounts.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, so last thing I will mention, because I want to make sure we didn't forget it, and is to say that there are other accounts, right? These are just a couple that we really wanted to zero in on because I think they are the few that most people are least familiar with. But we wanted to really highlight kind of the long-term implications of this. Again, in the article that we wrote, we spoke about how a simple $1,000 contribution that we're making this year and a continued $100 investment would actually turn into about $76,000 for them. And if we would increase that amount to like $1,500, it would be like well over $100,000. There's obviously more to that story because the reality is we're not starting from zero in that account. But the point is, it doesn't take this huge life-changing amount of money. Sometimes just these small contributions can lead to something really incredible for our children. But these are not the only types of accounts. Obviously, there are still checking accounts that you can have with children and you can set up at a bank. These are really, really simple to do. Some of them come in tandem with a savings account so that as they're earning income, likely having it directly deposited into that checking account, you can also transfer money seamlessly to a savings account just so that you can help them build that habit. If you're like me, when you were a kid, you also had your mom open up a certificate of deposit, which is not a type of account that you hear very much about these days. But the idea is that they're a little bit more restrictive than savings accounts and that you can't very easily go in there and withdraw that money. Typically, it's going to be held for certain periods of time. It could be 6 months, 12 months, 24 months, you name it. They're set up with different increments depending on the financial institution. But the reward for that restriction is that you're rewarded with a little bit of a higher interest rate than a savings. And then even beyond that, you have other types of savings accounts like money market accounts, which don't have the restrictions that certificates of deposit have. But they, one, require typically a significantly higher minimum deposit. Some I've seen as high as like $20,000, which is crazy. But you actually earn a little bit more for the money that you put into it. So those are just a couple of other options that you're thinking about what you want to do for your kids aside from buying them more toys and stuff for their birthdays and for the holidays.
All right. Final thoughts.
Let's do it.
So my final thought is that investing for kids is a great way to teach them about the economic system that they are inheriting or were born into. But please, please, please make sure that your own finances are in order first.
Yes.
There are plenty of options available for kids who grow up to be adults that didn't come from a family that stashed cash away from them. But if you don't have enough for retirement of your own or a fully funded emergency fund, you don't have nearly as many alternatives for yourself. So focus on those financial milestones first, and then move on to setting aside money for your kids in these various investment accounts and savings accounts and CDs. And, you know, you can come back and listen to this episode after you've gotten a good financial foundation for yourself.
Yeah, that's real. I will also add, if you're passionate like we are about building wealth, one of the core things I think a lot of us need to discard, or core ideas rather, is that like earning income happens between the ages of 18 and 65. We spend a lot of time talking about how even retirees, whether they're early retirees or people who are considered traditionally retired, are still working or earning income in some way. But we don't spend nearly as much time talking about how even kids today can earn income. And I think we've kind of lost our way as a country a little bit. I remember even when I was a kid, there used to be talks about kids having paper routes and doing those things. And now, like, we don't, yeah. I don't hear nearly as much of those kinds of things. Every now and then,
child labor is frowned upon.
Well, right. We look at it that way, but we hear some of these more exorbitant stories of the kid entrepreneur who started this thing. And I was like, yeah, there's a lot in between the kid who's running a paper route or playing video games and the kid who started a company and learned how to code when he was 10. You can literally still just work a couple of things every single year, make a couple $1,000s. And that simple thing, aside from going towards summer fund money, can actually be the big difference maker and fundamentally change the trajectory of your life when you graduate from college. And I think that's really the big thing here, is to help people to demystify how a lot of these things are done and say, actually, all you're really asking your kid to do is save a little bit of their earned income so that all of it doesn't go towards, honestly, let's just be honest, dumb stuff.
Yeah, slime and hair barrettes.
Toys and yeah. more just
iPhone
stuff,
cases.
Even if it's just a dollar.
Yeah.
Right?
Like those I wish
things
I had
can
had,
go a long, yeah. long way.
I wish I had this guidance when I was babysitting and pet sitting when I was, you know, 11 or 12. Like, this would have been huge. Talk about early retirement. This would have shaved 15 years off of my goals Easily. Because I would have started investing at Easily. The age of 13.
Easily. It would have fundamentally changed the way that we all view work. So that's what we want for every kid, for every adult that used to be a kid. And those are our final thoughts.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. If you like what you heard, please leave us a 5-star rating and review anywhere reviews are accepted. We will see y'all next week.